are listening to the Live Fix Podcast, the podcast that explores the concert fan experience. We believe live music is life-altering. Join us as we share stories and connect with concert fans to discover how live music forever rocks our world before, during, and after the show. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the episode.
Greetings, live music fans. We're excited to share with you an episode where we're going to explore the intersection between live music and golf. That's right, live music and golf. Super excited to get into this. We have a special guest and fellow concert fan and performing artist, Ty Thompson. Ty is a recognized expert in change leadership. He's a business consultant, he's a PGA professional, international speaker. He's also an award-winning past president of the Colorado PGA and a Gulf War Army veteran. You know, on this episode, we dive into these really intriguing stories that where Ty talks about performance and navigating failure and doing what he calls knowing how to turn down the volume when he's on stage to navigate these potential moments of failure. He also talks about this duality and almost the struggle of observing and participating, you know, wanting to just look out on the concert experience, but also participate in it at the same time. We talk about so many different artists. Ty has seen a lot of concerts and it's really fascinating. So we look at Michael Jackson concerts, Motley Crue, Van Halen, Toby Keith, a very interesting take on patriotism and immigration as Ty gets into his thoughts on that and Toby Keith. We talk about Alice Cooper, Zach Bryant, Dylan Scott, Firehouse, Johnny Cash, Diana Krall, Queen, and so much more. Fantastic episode. We love having Ty on the show. Hope you enjoy his stories. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Ty, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to talking about some music and some experience.
You're mentioning in our pre-show chat, it was helpful for you to kind of go back into you've got some interesting concert experiences, everything from Van Halen, Michael Jackson, Styx, you know, you as an artist. So you were able to go on both sides of our conversation here, you know, as a fan, as an artist. So tell us, you know, in what way has live music, you know, the live music experience changed your life?
You know, I think at first it was about going and being in awe of these artists and listening to their musicianship, and having grown up from a young age playing numerous instruments, you're intrigued by someone who can handle the pressure of getting up on stage, pulling it off, and being an entertainer. And so, you know, it was about friends. It was about relationships. It was about memories. I mean, I remember going to concerts that were about birthday celebrations. They were about reunions with friends. And so it was really about going and listening to the music. And I think over the course of my life, it became less about the being in the trenches of it for me. And I became more of an observer. I probably for the last 10 years, I'm 50 years old now. And for the last 10 years, I probably enjoy more sitting and watching what's happening at the concert versus being immersed in the midst of it. Maybe it's because I don't have as much energy and don't want to be in the mix of, you know, of the dancing or the mosh pit or whatever's going on. But it's just amazing to me watching musicians and having gotten to know some of them who are, you know, world-renowned artists. Then you watch them and you just know them as people. So it's such a different perspective to go, oh, we've played golf together, or we've hung out and had coffee together, and yet you've, you know, sold millions and millions and millions of albums. So that's a unique perspective as well.
What artists did you have those experiences with? I think you mentioned, I think Alice Cooper on your list of kind of working with him. And what other artists
I've been super fortunate with my relationship with Callaway. You know, I've been a PGA golf professional for almost 20 years. And so Callaway has been a sponsor of both of ours. If you remember way back in the day, Alice Cooper did some commercials, putting commercials, and he would leave it short of the hole and they would say, you know, hit it, Alice. So he's been a big proponent of the game of golf, and he really, the game of golf saved him in a lot of ways. He tells me one time when we were playing, I think we've played together four times. And he told me one time that in the early 80s, he made four or five albums that he has zero recollection of recording. He has no memory because of the drug and alcohol abuse and addiction. And so golf, he plays 6 days a week. A lot of people don't know that. So he plays 18 holes every day of the week, or 6 days, except for show days, and he plays nine. And so when he comes around to different towns, Callaway connects us. So they'll call us up. So over the time, I became friends with him and Ryan Roxy, his guitarist. And it's funny because I'm out there, and as a PGA professional, they're asking me for golf instruction. I'm asking for guitar instruction. You know, how do I get better at this? And you know, Roxy wants to, you know, how do I hit my driver further? So it's pretty funny. But it's been fun with Alice Cooper because I've been able to pick his brain. I mean, he told me things about Zappa and how they interviewed drummers back in the day, and his respect for people like the Foo Fighters and folks that make real, what he calls real rock and roll music, you know? And so he has this respect for the real musicianship of those who create music. But the other thing I love about Alice is whenever I see him, you know, he picks up right where you stopped, like you were friends. And, you know, then I'm fortunate. I got to know Darius Rucker's keyboard player, is a friend of my wife's from high school. And a real fun memory there. My daughter played competitive volleyball, and she was in charge of the social activity for the Nashville tournament. So we reached out to Lee and asked him if they were on tour. And he said, no, I'm going to be home that week. And so my daughter wrote the lyrics to a song, and Lee recorded an entire backing track for the girls. And then we brought them to their home or their studio. And he recorded an entire song where he got all the girls to either sing in groups or be in different parts. And they recorded this thing, and he showed him the experience of a artist coming into a studio. And then he cut that track and sent it to all of them. And it was really a neat experience to have things like that. And then, you know, I got to know Damon Johnson a little bit. He's right now the guitarist for Lynyrd Skynyrd. He finally got that opportunity to step in there, but he played with Thin Lizzy. Was his dream as a kid that he could grow up. And he saw that happen, that we met in an airport, standing in his security line. And I saw a sticker on his guitar, and he played with a country band. I think it was called Whiskey Falls years ago. And so it's just fun when you meet artists like that. And then you tend to follow them because you connect. You have a relational connection. So, and then in the golf world, you tend to run across artists that are engaged. You know, Darius Rucker is a huge proponent of the golf industry, does a lot out in South Carolina. But I first saw him, he was one of my early concerts. I signed with Hootie and the Blowfish. Mm-hmm. And we had a mutual connection of a gal who sang for him. And so we got to go backstage. And that was kind of the first experience of, oh, getting to go backstage and see the artist. So yeah, it's a cool intersection. Entertainers and golf tend to crisscross a lot.
What's the connection between golf and live music? Like, what would you say? You know, what would you say are some of the things that cross
over?
They're
very similar, maybe.
Yeah, as far as because they're both, you know, there's performance, you know, and there's fans and there's stages. You know, like, What have you gathered from being a performing artist and or watching other artists, and then, you know, your work with golf?
Well, one, it's about that moment of pressure. I mean, I've had moments playing golf where I wanted to crawl under a rock because I was playing so bad. And I've had moments on stage where, you know, you hit the wrong chords, you start a song wrong. And it's just this environment that it's not really about perfection. It's really about the journey of enjoying it, and people are gracious. But I think in the world of golf with fans is organizations like the PGA Tour and different events realized, wow, we have this captive audience of fans who love watching athletes perform, but they're only playing in the daytime. So why don't we start integrating concerts at nighttime? And so you see a lot of PGA Tour events, Korn Ferry events, where they utilize the evening entertainment piece very strongly to keep that fan engaged from the golf course to the environment. And a lot of times, I think fans come to the golf tournaments for the concerts. You know, they might be there really because of the artists that they love. And then in turn, they watch the golf tournament. They're like, wait, I really enjoy this too.
Yeah, it's like killing two birds with one stone. You know, you get to do the golf during the day and maybe that's your favorite sport to watch. And then you get to see a really great concert in the evening.
Mm. Yeah, I think the interesting thing too about connection between golf and live music, and this is more of like a difference. I often hear, you know, and I've seen artists flub something on stage, you know, and they always say, well, just keep going, you know, just like nobody notices it. But in a golf situation, much harder to hide
the fake
your mistakes. Would you agree with that? Like you can do something on stage, fans don't even know, maybe, you know, they're drinking a lot or it's loud, there's so many other sensory things going on, you know, they're not told to be quiet while the person, you know, is hitting me on the off of the tee. They want to get louder, you know. So it's interesting. Like, would you say that that's you know, kind of that's it play, that it's harder to play golf than it is to be a musician when it comes to dealing with, you know, mistakes and failure?
I would say in a lot of ways, golf is tough because there's no substitutes, there's no timeouts. You don't get to raise your hand and have the coach bring you in. I remember my daughter experienced this in high school golf, and she played a phenomenal front nine of golf and was playing great. And then the wheels just came off, and it happens in the game. And I was an assistant coach at the time for that team. And I remember going out and she's just in tears and it's embarrassing. And she's on an island, and I've been there. You're on an island. And so in playing music, I always tell people, I know how to turn the volume down. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is there's times where I've gotten lost. I just turn my volume down and keep jamming, in a sense. I mean, nobody out there knows that I'm not really coming through the speakers, you know, so you find yourself back and you bring your volume back in. So you're absolutely right. You have a team. That's the other thing with music I love too, is a lot of the lead guitar stuff or rhythm I play is I really enjoy finding what's not being played. And I like putting hooks into songs that don't normally get played when you're playing just, you know, we're garage band giggers, right? We're out playing bars or whatever it might be. So a lot of times you don't have enough musicians to fill in the parts that really make a song and create the emotion. And this one band I sit in and play with is called Playing With Smoke, and a great artist. And the drummer's a friend of mine. His cousin's actually the drummer for War. So, you know, Low Rider and all that. And so he's really been a great inspiration for me to get out and play more live music. But there's times that I go sit in with them and all I do is prepare. I went to some of their gigs and I just recorded them. I took a recorder and I recorded them playing, and I came home and I just listened to all their songs. And I said, what's missing? What licks are inside the song that you usually hear on an album? You know, there's a Darius Rucker song, Only Want to Be With You. And there's some real just kind of super simple licks in there, but it's the emotion of the entire song. Well, they never played that because they didn't have two guitarists to play it. Mm. So I love to surprise them. I show up to gigs and I sit in and play songs, and then I just start ripping some of those little simple melodies, and you see people in the audience perk up. Mm. You know, they know the song, but then when they hear those pieces and the band members turn around and give you a smile, you know, there's a connection. There's another song called For What It's Worth, and it's got some harmonics in the beginning. Well, hard to have one guy that just plays those, but their bass player, when I sit in and first played that, I thought he was just going to run off the stage. He was so excited to hear that harmonic ring, you know? So that's the difference I love about music, is you're a part of this team and you've got to find your role and where's your layer fit. A lot of bands to me that if you hear out in the community playing, that struggle is you have multiple people playing the same thing. Mm. So if you have two guitarists playing the same G power chord, it's just muddy and doesn't sound much. So I had to learn that over time, is, you know, space is okay, not playing is okay, and just fitting in. So, but with golf, it's like, here we go. if it's going bad, boy, we don't have time tonight for you to tell. I could tell you the times that I've played that it's just, you thoroughly are embarrassed, you know, especially as a professional. Mm. And, you know, people are looking at you like, how could you play so bad? And it just happens. I mean, even the tour players. I had a young man that I was fortunate to coach when he was 13, 14, and 15. And you know, he won the U.S. Open last year and won the Wells Fargo. And, you know, so, but he struggled over, there were many years he's on the tour and he'd go out there and shoot terrible rounds. And you're like, what happened? And then all of a sudden, you know, he makes $10 million and major champion and wow, all this stuff. But then, you know, this week he might miss the cut. You know, it's just crazy how it can be so up and down. So
do you notice the difference between the fans of golf and then the fans on a rock show or a country show, I should say, too?
I tend to see that a lot of people that are watching, especially if I'm playing, most of those people don't know how to play. So that's the other thing that's intriguing is the audience out there when I'm playing tend to not be a lot of artists. They're not there. They're there to enjoy. They're dancers. You know, they want to be on the floor. They want to have fun. Golfers, when you're out there playing, if you have people watching, they tend to be golfers at some level. They're in the game. And so they're watching going, how do I do that? Or how do I figure that out? And most bar gigs I play or whatever, they're ignoring you. I mean, right there, they're drinking and having a good time. Now, when I go to a show, flip that around, I tend to now always get a seat on the second level on the railing. And if I can't get a seat right there, I don't want to go because I want to sit. I don't like to stand a lot. And my wife is like, I know you're not going to talk to me during the concert because I literally just sit there and I'm not screaming. I'm not yelling. I'm not clapping. I'm just watching. And I'm watching that guitarist's hands. I'm watching what they're doing. I'm like, oh, that makes sense how they're doing that. So I'm probably the worst a spectator for them. If everybody came to the show like me, there would be no sound in there. They'd just be sitting there watching them play.
Well, I wonder how many artists do that, right? I mean, I love watching pictures of other artists watching other artists, you know, like guitar. I think it was like I saw this picture of like Tom Morello watching somewhat of Rage Against the Machine watching I forget what you know, punk band it was or something like that before they really blew up, you know, and just love trying to get inside their mind when they're doing that. And then you see other bands or other artists, you know, like jumping in the mosh pit, you know, and they're like feeling it. And, you know, they're, so it seems like there must be a spectrum, you know, of artists who do what you just described, who are there to as students. And then they're there as fans, you know, and they just want to experience the show just like they were any other normal fan, you know?
Yeah, I can see that. Even the guitar or the keyboard player that I sit in and play a lot with, he's a very experienced keyboard player and he hates to rehearse, never wants to practice on something because he said, I want to live in the moment of music. Like I'm a preparer. I want to know exactly what I'm going to do that night. I'm going to rehearse it. I'm going to know it because there's a panic that comes over me. I'm not a big improviser. Some guys can just show up and, oh, I didn't know we were going to play here. Give me a guitar. And they start playing. To me, I want to do it. And so for him, he's pushed me a lot to say, don't stress about it so much. Mm. You know, just try to go with the emotion of what we're doing and how we're playing. And so, yeah, it's kind of cool.
Who introduced you to live music?
Well, my first concert was with my dad, and I think it was probably him more out of guilt. My dad went through a second divorce when I was in fifth grade. So he decided to take my brother and I and two older girls that were friends of his best friend. It's funny, we were sixth graders, and they were like ninth and 10th grade pretty girls. And so we're like, oh my gosh, you know, we're getting to go with the, but we went to Van Halen 1984.
Nice.
And I'm not even sure my dad knew who that was, but all the kids wanted to go. So we got to ride along. And I remember asking my dad, what's that smell? You know, so I got introduced to what marijuana was at that first concert. Now, of course, I live in Colorado. It's legal. It's a whole different world. But I just remember standing there in awe. You know, you watch David Lee Roth jump off the speaker like he used to. And just the music was exhilarating. So you're like, I want to be a part of that, you know. And at the time I had just started band and music at our little town in Burley, Idaho, became huge. One teacher came in there. We had 550 kids in our high school. We had three jazz bands, three pep bands, 125 in the main band. So you think about how many kids that is involved. And so I played drums and trombone and sax, and started playing bass guitar in ninth grade in jazz. And so I got really mediocre at a lot of instruments. I never took enough time to really get great at one of them. I was so intrigued by the different instruments. My brother played trumpet and I just learned it at home. I'm like, I'm going to figure this one out. And so it's just been the last probably 10 or 15 years that I really honed in on guitar and said, I want to really push myself to go through the plateaus of, I mean, if you're going to be really great at an instrument, sometimes you have to really struggle at, you know, you get stuck. And I hired some folks. I played in a worship band for many years. And so I hired guys, and it's interesting. I went to a lot of lessons. We never played the guitar. We just sat and talked about music and how music fits together. And he would tell me, he said, you're like a yard filled with bricks, and I just need to take your bricks and put the building together. Because you have so much understanding in music, but you're missing where it all connects, you know, to be able to kind of ride with it. So that education was amazing. That was probably 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing, that analogy. And I'm curious about the first brick of your experience, which is seeing Eddie Van Halen perform live. I imagine you have a bunch of guitars on your
sell the ticket stub. That's my biggest question
on your wall there. And I'm wondering, like, what was it like for you to see, like, did seeing Eddie Van Halen, you know, do his thing live, inspire you in any way? Like, what was that first moment like for you seeing that? Was that a first brick in your, you know, your musical career, you know, or musical journey as a, you know, as a guitarist?
Yeah, I think it was a first brick. It's not like I left from there. I tried to play some guitar, and I think he was just, you know, I also played a lot of golf, and I played a lot of different things. And so what happened over time is I feel I have a curse and a blessing, and that, it's that I like a lot of different kinds of music. But because of that, I never really honed in and said, look, I'm going to be, you know, we loved Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses and Tesla and, you know, Def Leppard and all these bands. But I also listened to Michael Bolton and Luther Vandross and Eric Clapton and Rush. And I mean, it's interesting. I'm looking on, you can't see on this side of my room where I'm sitting, but around this surround of a fireplace, I took all the CD covers from my high school days, and they're all around. My wife said, you just have your scrapbook on the wall. But it literally, I go around the thing of Simon and Garfunkel and Dire Straits and Michael Hedges, Squirrel Nut Zippers. You know, I just had this, and I was enamored by really everything but rap. I had a hard time really connecting with hip hop stuff. But I really connected with Michael Jackson stuff. I mean, we used to carry our cardboard to school in our parachute pants and break dance. And our sixth grade talent show, our whole class did the Thriller video, you know? And so that was my introduction to kind of that R&B side that was really cool. And that's why it was amazing when I served in the military and was in Germany and Michael Jackson was coming. I said, I'm going. Yeah. And it was really an amazing experience to be there. So, yeah, I think it was the brick to say, I want to continue to dig into it. And
what do you remember about the Michael Jackson show?
One, I just remember I came from a little town, Burley, Idaho. I don't think I'd really been to any other concerts besides that Van Halen. Got in trouble in high school, so my parents grounded me from the Motley Crue concert. It was like the end of the world, you know? but I think it was the first stadium experience. You know, it was where the Frankfurt Galaxy play. I think there were 70,000 people there. And I just remember feeling so small. And we worked our way all the way up to maybe 15 rows back from the stage. There was a little group playing with them, opened for him, called ABC, Another Bad Creation. Yeah, I don't know if you ever remember that deal, but I remember watching them dance, and I'm like, these kids are like 12, you know, and watching an artist like that. But the Michael Jackson experience to me was just the enormity of that show and the things he did on stage, and the, you know, he had all his tricks of fans coming from the bottom of the stage. But more than anything, I just was blown away by how many people would, you know, just pack a stadium to that level. So, and then his artistry, I mean, you just feel like you're, I feel very lucky that I got to watch him perform. A lot of people miss that, you know.
And I do think with when people serving in the military, they sometimes get some great opportunities to see live music. Sometimes it is actually on the base. You know, it's a celebration for something or an honoring the troops. And so I think that there is always that correlation between the military and live music, like celebrating the military. Did you have a lot of concerts on the base? Did you live on a base?
We didn't where I was. I lived outside of Frankfurt, and it was during the Gulf War. So there was not a lot of concerts going on. It was, you know, I did not go down to Iraq, but I was alerted to go to Iraq once. We prepared to go down there, and then they canceled it, and then to Afghanistan. So it was more about readiness. But now I think there's a lot more, especially stateside, you know, and I think there's a real pride that artists take to say, I'm going to go overseas and serve the troops, and I'm going to go put on a concert. And I think a lot of times they do it for free, and they just want to serve in that way. But I mean, gosh, that probably even goes back to the days of Bob Hope and folks like that, right? Did stuff like that.
But Marilyn Monroe, I think there was some live shows she did for a while there. Marilyn Monroe and some of those big bands, I think, too, did performances.
Yeah, it's important because it gives them a moment to escape, you know, and live outside of the world they're living in, whether it's even now today, our soldiers spend more time deployed than they do at home. So, I mean, I had a great experience, had a great time. But, you know, you serve in the military, it's about, you know, defending the country. So I will say the concert to me that connected with me the most from the military was Toby Keith at Red Rocks. So I got an opportunity to go watch Toby Keith at Red Rocks. And I'm telling you, at the end, I often tell people it should be part of the immigration process. You have to, you know the Constitution. You have to go through these laws, these rules, and attend a Toby Keith concert. Because when you get done, you feel so patriotic, you know. I mean, it was incredible. That was one of my favorite concerts. The energy, the patriotism, you're proud, you know. And these days in our country, you know, we're just so many people are tearing each other apart. And I think music breaks that down to where it says, okay, let's put all the differences aside and let's use music and let's all be in the room here. Republicans, Democrats, Jews, Christians, but it doesn't matter. You know, we're here to celebrate this pride of music. And so that's a memory I'll just never forget at Red Rocks. Of course, living in Colorado, I've been able to go there to quite a few shows and I have a lot of cool memories at Red Rocks, but.
We haven't had a chance to see Red Rocks or be at a Red Rocks show. We've been around it during or before a concert, but I wanted to ask you about, and hopefully we can get there sometime too, because that's on our bucket list. You mentioned something super interesting there, and you kind of hinted at it a little bit in some of your storytelling, and you know, reminiscing about your experiences. And I was wondering about your sense of community at the shows, you know. And I think, you know, live music is this unique thing that can bring us together. And sometimes it can separate us. You know, some people want to go to different types of shows and they won't go to another show. But more and more people we talk to, you know, with the advent of technology and, you know, all these different genres, you know, people go metal, you know, metal heads or, you know, heavy metal don't just go to heavy metal shows. They go to different types of concerts and vice versa. So what's your thoughts on the community, you know, sense of community in the shows that you've been to? Like, did you feel more connected to the people that you went with after the show? Like, or, you know, the people, did you feel a connection with people when you were at the show?
I'm assuming you're referring to the people I didn't know, like the people I didn't go with. And, I think I'll answer it both ways. Definitely, you feel a connection, you feel a memory, and you tell the stories for years to come, right?
Yeah.
And it's like fishing or hunting. I think the stories get better as the years go by.
Nice.
But, you know, it's interesting because I think I've had, my experiences have been one of two ways. I mean, there's been times I've gone to concerts and been super frustrated with the people around me. Like they're rude or they're annoying or, you know, they're too drunk to like, you know, let everyone around them enjoy it. So that's frustrating at times. But I think for the most part, when you go, you see people giving to one another around them. You know, if a kid can't see, people tend to like do something to, you know, hey, come over here, you know, and sit by me or, you know, get up on here. And so I tend to see more of that for sure. I will tell you, I had an interesting experience when I go to Alice Cooper, when I play golf with him and he comes around and I usually have backstage passes and I'll take friends that haven't gotten to meet him yet or whatever. And we'll go to the shows. And so he wanders with different folks, right? He's played with Motley Crue. I think he had one show with Motley Crue and I don't know if it was Def Leppard or who it was, but it's funny. He's the opener now instead of the headliner. And so he says, I love it because I'm home by 9 and I'm tired, you know, 70 years old, but awesome. He toured one time. They put him with like 30 shows with Marilyn Manson. Mm. And he told me it was hard for him. And in fact, we're playing golf one time and he's about to hit this shot in the middle of the fairway. And he stops and turns around and he goes, by the way, would someone tell Manson, we know you're angry. Now shut up and play some decent music. And so I was at Red Rocks and Cooper was playing there, but Manson was opening. And I was so blown away at the people that were at the show. I mean, I became a very big people watcher in that moment. Like what connects? This is doing something for these people. Mm. Now I had to go all the way to the back of Red Rocks in the top because it's an angry, unsettling sound that gets produced with that level of music. But I remember thinking to myself from the top, I'm watching down going, this meets a need of some sorts with these folks. And I mean, I never really figured out what that was, but I go, thousands of people don't show up to listen to this unless it meets a core emotional need to them. So I guess in that sense, I felt connected to them to go, I don't understand it, but I get it and I appreciate it. I don't know if that answers it, but.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting that you bring up a great point, you know, about like, what is it about certain type of music, certain type of artist, the message that is inside that music and is in some way connecting with something that people feel deeply about, right? You know, there's certain songs that I'll just sing, you know, and then others that I, you know, I'll listen to, but I won't sing the lyrics to, you know, or something like that, or in a certain, you know, certain settings, I'm like you said, you're, you know, we're as fans, we're observers. And then in other instance, you know, in the other situations, we're active participants, you know, and I think that that's interesting because in a community setting, you can flow between those two, you know, those many different, you can be a lurker, you know, you can be, you know, an influencer, you can, you know, be the actual center of that. You can be a contributor, you know, you're commenting. And in a concert experience, you have that same, you know, and you need all of those elements in order for a community to thrive. And I think in a concert experience, it's that same, I've noticed the same, you know, breakdown and, you know, in environments where you need the artist needs the fans, and the fans have to connect with something. And then, you know, that's you, you know, like you said, you were observing that whole piece. And when you're looking at that, you know, you do wonder like, what is that about that crowd and, you know, specifically their hearts and minds and what they're feeling that something like that, you know, is, you know, like, you know, resonating with them. You know, it's why do people not mosh at a Michael Bolton concert? Obviously because of the music, but, you know, there's something going on that's different between, you know, maybe the hearts and minds at that moment, you know.
I think a show can be a release for some too, you know, when you talk about metal or you talk about hip hop. I know there's obviously clients that I've worked with that they go to a show and it's just a release. They've had built up anger, built up, but maybe it's sadness, it's frustration of life. And, you know, they'll go and it's just, I'm going to yell out those lyrics because they ring true to me. Maybe I don't have the words, but, you know, the musician has created these words for me. And I think that that's where a lot of times that hip hop fan comes from, is that they may be able to relate to the lyrics. And so when they sing it, it's really just a release for them. They don't know how to do it in another way. I mean, you even see that when people, I think, listen to music and they're singing it and they're yelling it. It's, again, a way to release. But when you have a whole crowd of people, there's potentially a lot of emotions involved and you're releasing. It is very powerful. It can be.
Yeah, I think you notice also folks let their guard down, right? You know, you maybe live a lot of ways in our lives, putting on a, we got to be professional in this environment. We got to be this, we got to be controlled, we got to be that. And it's like, you know what? I can just, for lack of better words, let my hair down and just, you know, I know my daughter loves that. I mean, she loves hitting concerts and just saying, look, let's just enjoy it. And who cares what you look like? And who cares, you know, what it is? Let's just have fun and, you know, dancing around. And she's the one we went to Mexico for a vacation down in Cabo, and the local Mexican team had won the national championship. And I turn around and find out she's on this video where they put a sports jersey on her and they're throwing her up in the air and she's in the middle of the crowd. I said, that's what she does at every concert. You know, she's the one in the middle of the pit. So I know for them, that experience, and it's kind of like, let's just do this. Let's have fun. So
how have you connected with your daughter through live music? Like, what are some experiences that you guys have had together?
Well, it's crazy because I don't know if I can hang with her much. So we've not had a lot of concert experiences. She does more of that with my wife. But I'm trying to think of the ones we've done more. We've gone to New York City a number of times, and we spend, you know, 3 or 4 days out there kind of experiencing that environment. I don't know if we've had any concerts together. My wife's gone to a number of concerts with her. Oh, you know what I did? I took her to one of her first concerts when she was very young, took her to Hunter Hayes. And I'm trying to remember who you want to talk about a great musician. Says Hunter Hayes. Anyways, he's the guy who, I mean, he's a drummer, a lead singer. I have to remember, he's a country artist. He played it here in Colorado Springs, and she was about 12. So we're talking about a decade ago. So we did go to some of those. And then my daughter took her to Carrie Underwood. And I mean, she was begging to go to concerts at, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old. So I have to think, I haven't thought much on that. See, now I'll be pondering afterwards. We're going up to see her next week in Boise. So we'll be talking music.
It is amazing.
The one bummer is I've never been able to get her to play instruments. I'm like, would you please get in here? Play bass guitar, so play keyboard or something.
She more likes the experience and the, you know, not playing, but observing and receiving the music.
Yeah. You know, the coolest live experience I have with my daughter was, I think it was sixth grade. She asked me to play acoustic guitar and accompany her in a, like a talent deal at school. And she sang this Taylor Swift song. And so, one thing that was, so I did that. I learned this song and we played, and she's actually extremely brilliant musically, even though she doesn't spend a lot of time on music. I'm learning that song. She's a sixth grader, I think. And she said, you're playing it wrong. She turns to me and says, you're playing the song wrong. And I said, what do you mean I'm playing it wrong? She goes, you're changing the chords too early. And I said, which one? She goes, I don't know what they're called. It's the one that goes from the happy chord to the sad chords. And it was going from like a G to an A minor. And she like picks this out as like this young kid. I said, that's incredible that you have that kind of ear and tone. And so last week she was at I don't know if she was at a concert or I think she was out at a deal with friends in college. She FaceTimed me at 1 o'clock in the morning, woke me up, and it's the Taylor Swift song playing that we played. And she wanted to FaceTime me to, you know, say, I love you. And, you know, this memory's big to me of us playing this together, you know, so many years ago. So, I mean, that to me is pretty cool.
So she was at a Taylor Swift show?
Wasn't at a show. She was at a pub or something, or some country bar in Boise or whatever. And I think it's called Rowdy's. And that song came on. And so she wanted to FaceTime, and you know, it just has a big emotional connection to her, to that memory back when we played and she sang that song and I played for her as a little girl, you know. So obviously meant enough to her that she would FaceTime me and wake me up at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I thought maybe she was doing that to say, this is how it's supposed to sound, Dad. Is that?
Yeah, no. Maybe that's what it was. Listen right here to the right. You know, we pulled it off that day. We got it right on the performance day. But
oh, that's awesome.
I often wonder, like, why some people at birth just gravitate towards live music and music in general, and then why some people are like, I never want to go to a show. I mean, what? Like, and they barely listen to an album, or music isn't a big part of their background noise as they're growing up. I often wonder, what's the difference? Is there a formula that, you know, potentially parents are doing different than parents who kids are really into it versus parents that are not? And I know Chris and I have talked a lot about it, because with our first, I was taking guitar lessons. We were doing shows. We didn't have kids. So we had only the one in the belly. So we weren't.
Yeah, she was pregnant.
And he's pregnant super into music. He plays the piano. Yeah. He's like super into music. And so I don't know. I wonder if that isn't part of it, as if you're exposing them really young. Did you guys go to any live shows when the baby was young, or when your wife
was pregnant? We went to them, but not so much with her. But I mean, the big thing with her is, I come to find out later, like, she's so talented. I mean, she could sing so well at 4, 5, 6 years old. And I think she was afraid of the perfection, afraid of the, you know, later she realized I just didn't want to move forward to it. My brother-in-law, okay, here's a great story. My brother-in-law is, when he got married to my wife's sister, he was one, maybe the number one or number two rock star in Russia. And so he saw my daughter singing at like 4 or 5, and he's like, dude, your daughter, she has music through her bones and her soul. And I said, well, okay, I guess I'll respect you, since, you know, you have 7 albums out. And we went to their wedding in Russia, in Moscow, in 1999. And I think they had 2,400 people at their wedding. The private reception was like 400 at the first club that he did a show at. And so that's a fun connection we have there too with him. Just a side note of, you know, he's such a celebrity over there. And is, you know, he launched the only Christmas album ever to be put out in Russia, and recorded in 3 languages on it. So that's a fun connection with him. But it was interesting for him to see that. He goes, neither of my daughters have any of that. They have like no talent when it comes to, and he goes, her timing, her ear, her tempo. And I go, yeah, but she won't take it serious. So it like drives you bonkers, you know. But anyways, it's good. My son, he connects with music in a whole different way. He doesn't want to play, but he's gravitated completely to indie music. And he loves to just go get in his car. And he's a quiet, contemplative, very wise young soul. But he just loves to drive. And he went out to Kilby Fest last year. That's what he wanted for his graduation present, was to go to Salt Lake. Have you heard of the Kilby Fest?
No,
it's a big indie. It's a big indie, you know, the Gypsies and some different folks like that. So I think they're going again this year. But kind of cool to see him want to go connect. And, you know, he spent 3 days at that festival. I told him the only way he could go is if his daughter would drive, or if my daughter would drive from Boise State and join him. And so that's what she said. Absolutely. So she went down there and they spent 3 days at this festival listening to live music. And
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in the questions that you, we asked you about, you know, the important elements of a show, you could choose the band, the venue, who you're with, where your seats are at, how much you paid. And then, you know, we give you an option to, you know, enter in a couple other ones. You chose where your seats are at. I think I understand that one, because you're an observer, and you want to be very particular about how you can see the stage. And then you chose sound quality. But why did you choose those two as opposed to the others?
One, I just think I'm an audiophile nut. You know, I like things to be, I love great sounding music. When I was in the military, Well, it started way back in high school. I mean, I bought these speakers from, you know, I went to, saved up to go to the local Radio Shack and buy these big 15-inch subwoofer speakers. And I'd sit in my room and listen to, I think that's where I really became appreciative of Michael Bolton and Luther Vandross and stuff. Is the music they made was just, when you heard it on good sounding system, it was just golden. I mean, it's just so good. And so in the military, I spent a bunch of money on the first Bose AM5, you know, satellite speakers and a Nakamichi receiver. And I still have that set up today, 30 years later, and it still just pipes golden stuff. So when I go to a show, if the sound's not good, I've left shows before that when the sound's not up good, I don't enjoy it. I want to, because it does something to you. Like when you have great sound, it like moves your soul. Mm-hmm. And it's the same when I play live. It drives me nuts when the kick drum isn't mic'd right. And you're not getting that thump that's kind of going into your soul when you're playing, in the sound and the clarity. So to me, even performing live, it's really important to me, the sound quality. It's not just about noise. It's about, are the dynamics right? And so when I've gone to shows, that's what I really appreciate about artists that can really put together, you know, music that, or sound systems or quality. It doesn't have to be huge. I mean, I remember going to Red Rocks to watch Goo Goo Dolls, and they actually were not that great that day. I think they'd had a little too much of the sauce. And so, but what blew me away was the first of three opening acts was a young girl named Colby Kaye. Hmm. Have you ever heard that name?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
she was a nobody then. And my wife and I got there early. It was a beautiful, sunny summer day, and the sound quality was so good. And you hear her singing, you're just like, it's like an angel playing a guitar. Mm. And this sound quality. And I just, my wife and I are like, this girl's going to be huge. And, you know, now you look at her and, you know, Bubbly's played everywhere and the whole deal. So, but yeah, that's why I put sound quality is it moves you, and bad quality distracts me. So I want to be moved by it. I want it to be same with worship music. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a bad, I've been to services or deals of worship music and it's distracting, it doesn't connect you. And so that's big. And the sitting thing, obviously I like to observe, I want to watch what's going on. Sometimes I like to be able to see the soundboard people and what they're doing. You can see that connection between what they're producing, but it's very different today, right? Than it was all these years ago. You know, you said something earlier that really resonated with me. You talked about lyrics. Mm-hmm. And how you'll it sounds like you can remember lyrics to songs, and they're it's like poetry to you, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I have a problem. I can't remember lyrics.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah.
I often listen to songs and I couldn't even tell you what they're about. But I can tell you how the music is formed together, and I can tell you how the licks in the guitar or the beats, whatever. I remember one time when we were first married, I'm listening to this Uncle Cracker song. Hmm. And it's the greatest, you know, you're a fish in the sea, that whole song. And it's just got a great bebop, you know, it's ear candy. And my wife goes, that's a terrible song. You know, that song's about like adultery and, you know, fighting the mistress. I go, it is. Right? And so I go back and listen to it. I go, oh, you're right. It doesn't have good lyrics, but I literally don't know the lyrics to so many songs. And I've always been jealous of people who can remember them and just recite them. I remember as a youngster in high school, I would write the lyrics out, or I'd get the CD out or the cassette tape back in those days. And I would try so hard to memorize them. I'm like, something's wrong with me. Why can't I remember these lyrics? And we just celebrated my cousin, his 54th birthday. And he was a lead singer in a band when we were growing up and played at Pepperdine. He's a doctor now. And so we did karaoke at his house. And every song, it didn't matter what I did, I'd put a song on. And this guy just starts singing the lyrics. I'm like, how in the world is your brain just filled with all those lyrics? So good for you that you remember. I don't connect so much with the words. I connect with the music.
Yeah, it's funny, man. I mean, I don't necessarily know all the lyrics all the time, but there's certain songs that resonate, and lyrics do a few things for me. They tend to ignite something, whether it's the message, and sometimes I like to strip down a song, deconstruct it, and if I can see that, yeah, this song could be just the lyrics, because the lyrics are musical, and the way that the artist performs them turns into a band itself. Hip hop and spoken word tend to be really great like that, where the artist can, in their own mouth, is the instrument. A lot of like KRS-One is like a hip hop example, but then you look at like Zach De La Rocha from Rage Against the Machine, like his actual, I think his mouth and his, like, he is an instrument, like how he delivers it, and other people have said that about in that way, and that got me into thinking like, oh wow, well, there's the lyrics themselves, and then there's how the lyrics are delivered, and then there's how the lyrics and the delivery fit with the music, and I think when a band has great lyrics that could stand alone, and they have the amazing music on top of it, and they have like this message in the music, like that's like a, for me, when I look at all my favorite songs, like those elements are all like part of that. And that's when I tend to like remember the lyrics, and they'll kind of come out, we're playing around the house with the kids, and I'll just be like, bup, 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 and like it'll, say something in some way, and they're like, what is that? Oh, that's a song, that's a lyric from a song, or just something like that. But that breakdown of the lyrics tends to be, that's when I memorize them. I don't necessarily have like a photographic memory, but all of that kind of,
Right.
it has to have some kind of emotional connection to that. And it probably doesn't hurt that I've heard the song 1,000 times. That tends to help. But I think it is that emotional connection too. It's interesting. We'll be at a concert, and and I've noticed this too about myself, or just in general, where we'll have a certain lyric song, and I can memorize song lyrics, I can memorize the moment, but in other aspects of my life, if you ask me to take the ACT, like I can't remember that, or what's, certain math equations, right? Or it's time to learn that Greek, you have to recite the this passage, in Greek. I'm like, can I put it to hip hop music, professor? No, you have to, you got to do that, or can I rhyme it, or something like that. So that's, and I think that's what makes, the live music experience amazing, because everybody, when an artist can put his or her lyrics out, and then the fans shout them back, there's that one moment. I don't know, I'm forgetting who it was. The Orange, the song The Orange, is that the, I
I
think,
think that's Luke Bryant, right?
is it Luke Bryant? But he's performing, they're performing at Red Rocks, and he gets to a point in the song and he says, hey everybody, I trust you. And he's saying that because,
It's a live version of it, yeah.
is it The Orange, I think? I think that's amazing, because that's, that's a lyrical moment between the fans and the band, and the artist is now, he says, whenever he says that, it gives me chills, because I'm like, ooh, that's like a deep connection between the artist and the fans and that whole crowd.
Yeah.
Like, they're,
Is that
everybody's
Tennessee
like,
Orange?
Tennessee, is it Tennessee Orange?
It
I'm
might be,
totally,
yeah, it might
I'm
be.
forgetting
I
it,
think
but
it's is it Zach Bryan?
Yes,
Zach
right.
Bryan.
Yes.
Might be Zach Bryan, Tennessee Orange, where the young girl has the conflict between, she's supposed to be a Alabama fan or something, or she's that's cool though, that,
But I think that's the, and it's a live version. I think
It's called Something in the Orange.
something in the Orange. That's
Yes.
right.
Yep.
That's it. And I think it is at Red Rocks. It's a live version of that song, and he's singing it. You could feel the emotion from the crowd in the recording. And then the song gets to a certain point, and he knows, everybody knows this lyric, and he's like, okay, I
The
trust
crowd
you.
singing, yeah.
And then he hands over the chorus to the song, and it's an amazing moment, because there is a lyrical moment. So that's why, when you asked me that, it reminded me of that moment. And some bands, like, they don't like that, right? I've seen Radiohead get annoyed when the fans are singing their song. I think there's a recording of them
Creep.
singing Creep, you know, and Thom Yorke just like he hands them like, and he's just like, okay, like go ahead. You know, he's kind of like, get it out.
And some don't give that opportunity.
Done with
You know,
it, you
some
know, and they
artists
don't
don't even
want that, right?
give that option.
They want to perform. They don't want to have that. You know, I always think it's interesting. Different artists, you know, can have that connection or they want that connection, where some artists just like, just let me sing the song. You came here to hear me sing, right? Not everybody else. And it
That
was like,
that's intriguing.
what a miss, right? Because that's like, you want your fans, I would think, to like have that sense of connection with you and with each other. That you, why would you want to stop them? You know, and certain genres take advantage of that, the call and response, you know, with hip hop or with soul, with funk, like, let me hear you, boom. And there's like a, you know, the trading back and forth, or just examples of lyrics are fantastic.
Yeah, I think you nail it on the connection piece, right? I mean, that's what most people want to do when they hit a concert. You know, as you reminded me of another show I went to here in Colorado Springs at a little place called Whiskey Baron. Maybe has 700 people, and I couldn't believe it. We ended up snagging these really inexpensive tickets to Dylan Scott. Do you know who that is? So
I've
he's a
heard of them,
country
yeah.
artist, and he was leaving. I don't know if it was somewhere in Kansas City, and he was headed to another venue. I mean, so he's doing these thousands and thousands of people in stadiums or whatever, right? And he does this show for 700 people in at the Whiskey Baron, and I mean, just loved it because he was just talking about, I'm here because you want to hear my music. We want to connect. He goes, I don't care if there's 70 people standing here or 700, you know. It was a cool show. I mean, you're just sitting in this small venue. So you see these artists that they remember where they came from. They remember playing the honky tonks, or they remember playing the, you know, the metalhead bars, and that's what really meant to them. So it's pretty cool to see. You know, you talked about the connection of songs. I'd be interested to know, do you guys have certain songs that as soon as you hear them, they lock you into a moment in time, like a location, a place, whether it's a concert or whatever, but you go, oh, this song just transports me.
For sure. Yeah. I think for me, it's some Bob Marley songs, Police. You know, those were songs that I remember as a kid. We must have like some kind of strong ability as kids, more so than adults, to just take in the music and environment that's going on. I'm sure there's a lot of research on that because I can go back to, yeah, being a kid. You know, playing in the living room and spinning around and listening to the Police and dancing and Culture Club was another one that I can remember. Madonna, obviously I'm an 80s kid, you can tell, but remembering that. And I haven't got an opportunity to see a lot of those guys live. I'd love to. I think that would come full circle for me. It's not always enough to just hear it in my car or while I'm doing the dishes or while I'm, I don't know, hanging out, listening to it. It's not the same, as I think if I would have seen it live.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, when you
Yeah.
were talking about that, it instantly made me think of are you know the band Firehouse? And that was big for me when I was in the military in 91, 92. I got to Europe, got my first car, you know, put a sound system in, and boy, I tell you, that album comes on and it just transports me to that moment. And it's pretty cool when you hear stuff like that. And I love tunes like that, you know, that you just connect and you go, yep, that's where it is. I hear Toto, and I can remember just, you know, I had kind of a rough high school time with my family, and I just remember being in my room and I had a drum set, and you can play Toto or you can play Whitesnake. And I just remember sitting in my room, jamming on my drum set, and make it as long as I could before my mom yelled down the stairs to knock it off, knock it off, you know. But yeah, that's the cool stuff about music
I have
for
a
sure.
sound question for you because you know a little bit more about sound than I do. Do you feel like there is any way that you know that live show can be enhanced with the quality of the sound? Is there a way that we could be more innovative in that? Is there any kind of technology that's coming out that could totally enhance the live music experience? I'm thinking of the Sphere, which we've talked about a couple times. That's very image based, but is there a way that
Las Vegas Sphere?
Yeah, the Las Vegas Sphere. Is there a way that we can increase or put some more innovation into the sound quality, you think, at a live show?
Well, I think what's interesting is, have you ever noticed when you get closer to the stage, sometimes the sound's not as good? Like you're in the gap, right? The main tower is going over your head. And so then they try to put things up front on the stage to try to hit you. It makes me wonder at some point, I mean, you think about how good certain earbuds are or certain personal experiences. What's going to happen the day that you show up with your own, you know, are they going to start to augment things to where you're piping in to your own experience with your own device through AI or whatever it might be? Even if it's an enhancement to what you're already hearing, because concerts tend to be in your face. Yeah. Sound is coming directionally at you. There's not a lot of places that surround you with sound unless you have a house set up where they play in that environment all the time. So I think it'll be intriguing to see what they're always coming up with, some kind of a deal. But I think the more permanent establishments are easier to do that, even if they're indoor or outdoor. But when they're traveling and having to set up, you know, every other night, but they're pretty darn good at it. I mean, you hear this stuff, but you know, a lot of times you get up in the top of a stadium, you got a bunch of echo and reverb and stuff, and it's hitting you. And it's, I don't sit up there anymore just because I can't see them and the sound's not great. I want to sit. I kind of know my sweet spot now. And unfortunately it's where the tickets typically cost the most because they know that's the best zone to sit in. And so I'd rather go to less concerts and spend, you know, money on a higher ticket to have just that sound. I remember going to see Diana Krall, and that's another transport for me. When I did my MBA work, when I did all my schoolwork, I played Diana Krall. And I love that jazz. In fact, I think if you look up here, you know, for those that can see video, you can see one of her albums up here.
Yep.
My wife had no idea how I didn't fall asleep every time I tried to study, you know, listening to this jazz music. But to me, it just locked me into a zone. I could have put on rock music. I could put on anything else, and I couldn't focus. But just playing that. And so it was one of my birthdays. My wife surprised me and got me tickets to a live show of hers. And it was incredible. She probably had 15 musicians on stage. And the sound that they produced, and just, I mean, it was just it's one of those shows that's not loud. It's not like in your face. It's just engulfing. I mean, it just like wraps you into the sound that's coming out of the music. So, and you can't fake that stuff. I always tell people you can't fake jazz and you can't fake country. You can fake rock and roll. You can fake 70s, you know, bar music. I can fake that stuff all day. But when you get into real country stuff and real jazz as an artist, you can't fake that stuff. That's real musicianship right there.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. When you you strip away certain elements, you know, the emotional content, whether it's there or not, especially when it's not there, is evident. When you're able to strip down a song to its core, if it's a good song, there's something emotional there that's driving the, you know, that's the epicenter of that song, why it moves you. And I was curious about your love for sound, because we've had certain guests and we asked questions in different ways about the five senses, you know, sight, sound, taste, smell, all that stuff. And what you're saying is super intriguing, because I'm wondering, you know, do you have a connection between the what you're hearing and what you're feeling, not feeling emotionally, but feeling touch-wise? Because we've had certain guests say that they really want to get up to the stage so they can literally put their body on the speaker, so they feel like they literally physically feel touch, you know, with the music, or they want to feel, you know, that bass, you know, like moving them, because it's mimicking, they may not know this consciously, but subconsciously it's mimicking their, you know, the heart, you know, the beating of the heart that we hear all the time in our existence, but we can't hear it because of where our body is made. But live music mimics that beat, you know, that thumping, you know, kind of sound. So do you have that, like, do you feel that connection when you're there and you're in that sweet spot, you know, sitting there, you know, does the music, you know, touch you as far as how it sounds coming of the speaker into your actual body.
It does. And what a great explanation of that, you know, that as a consumer of music, when I'm at a live show, I want to feel that resonance. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to feel that low end. I don't want to, certainly don't want a piercing, screeching, you know, sound coming through your ears. But when you can feel a little bit what I referred to earlier about being able to have a kick drum mic'd properly, you know, or a drum set mic'd properly. It's one thing I love about Metallica and that style of music is what Lars does and what he created in that style. I mean, it just goes through your body, you know, that double kick drum, metal feel, metal, but they wouldn't be able to create that without the sound. If they didn't have the sound reproduction of that, they would never create that sense of connection in that. So from a consumer, I love that. I mean, give me all of that, right? Mm-hmm. But as a performer, most of your listeners are going to hear the audio side. They can't see behind me with these two amplifiers, but these amps I've modified and put different speakers in there because I like them to be behind me when I'm performing, and I drive them through me to the audience. A lot of artists will have an amp to the side or, you know, to the back or whatever. When I feel it coming through me into the audience, I really connect with what I'm playing. So I tend to like that experience better. Now you have to have more power and whatnot to drive through your body and get to the audience. But I like that sensation. I like that feel. And it's usually why most of my family leaves home when I practice. Because I have it rather loud and the neighbors gonna all hear it. And
so they don't like that live music experience when you're playing for them.
You know, they have fun with it. We have, believe it or not, I have a group of guys with next door to me and next door to him and three houses down, all phenomenal musicians. Great. One of them toured with Lita Ford. And so we will throw out Spotify lists for a jam night. And we have one rule. You can add any song and delete any song. So if someone puts a song on you don't like, you can delete it. And so what happens is we're throwing songs up, deleting songs, and then pretty soon we have 20, 24 songs. And then I'll throw up there and say, hey, here's our first 10 songs. See y'all on Friday night. And everybody comes over and we just play, and we'll play 10 songs, and everybody's already prepared and ready to go. And we have a good time. We play some live music and head home for the night. You know, I mean, we might play for 2 hours, two and a half, but everybody already knows what we're going to play. And it's just so fun because, I mean, the one guy, Dave, who moved here from Chicago, is one of the best guitarists I've ever seen. And he's like a genius on guitar. He came over one time and I said, do you know any Stevie Ray? And he's one of those guys that doesn't talk. He just starts playing. So he starts playing Little Wing and literally played it from start to finish. And all of us stood there with our jaw just dropped. And I'm just like, can you do that again? So I can just try to play with you. So we played again and everybody wanted to join in and be a part of that because it was so incredible. So then I'm like, do you know any Guns N' Roses? And he's like, which one? And I mean, he literally played Welcome to the Jungle, start to finish, all the solos. I could name songs and he just is playing them. I'm like, I didn't prep him. And so I'm like, you know, it's just cool to see musicians like that. So I get to experience a lot of live music just here in my home in this music studio that I built for that reason, was to bring friends together. We prepare. So a lot of it's not even playing out to big crowds. It's just playing live music for the enjoyment of being together and playing live music. And it moves all of us. I mean, it's cool to be together, four of us. My family comes home, they end up peeking through the door. Everybody starts listening, you know, hey, why don't you play a concert? And, you know, we ended up doing that last summer. We have a friend who owns 35 acres and we took a band out there and just did a whole night of live music for all of our friends. It was just friends and family and played 3 or 4 hours that night of just live music. So something we totally love. I wish I had more time to do it, you know, and it's pretty cool to hear what, what's amazing is when you look at certain artists, like, let me give an example, like maybe a Tom Petty, right? Tom Petty is, now most people would love to hear someone else besides Tom Petty sing his songs because they think he's a little whiny, you know, but his music, it's incredible to me. That's one guy I wish I would have seen live. I never got to see him live, but you know, he could take three notes on a guitar and create a hook that every one of us knows what it is. You just start playing it and you'll go, I know exactly what that song is. And that's the genius to me of music, is if somebody can create something like that, it creates a connection with somebody. It's so simple and it's so good. You know, someone like Stevie Ray and Jimi Hendrix, they're all over the guitar and they're shredding and doing all this stuff. And that created an emotion too. Mm. But a guy like Tom Petty, three notes, three chords, and boom, just connected. Whether he's with, what was his first band, Mudcrutch? Mm-hmm. And then he played with the Traveling Wilburys. So that's one guy I wish I would have been able to see. And that small note, hopefully I'm not, you know, taking over here on this piece of it, but it's just kind of cool. I get to talking about it. It gets me excited. But I remember the one or two or three note hour when I was in college at Boise State. B.B. King came through with Kenny Wayne Shepherd. Kenny Wayne was 17 years old. And I said, I got to see these people. And everybody knows, right? B.B. King can play one note. And it's just like sings to your soul, you know, and he plays two or three notes. And then you hear Kenny Wayne Shepherd and you're like, who is this? Mm. I mean, it was incredible to hear his music back then. But you're like, he's not even playing. You're looking at B.B. King going, he's not even playing anything. Playing like two licks, you know, and they call it BB's box on guitar, if you've ever heard of that. Yeah. And it's literally just this one spot on the guitar that's three to five notes. And every guitar instructor I've worked with says, you need to try to stay, take your real estate on the guitar and limit yourself. Mm. Give yourself three notes and that's all you can play, and come up with as many emotional connections you can by playing three different notes. Rhythmically, tonally, pattern wise, and say something. That's the biggest thing I learned in music is they say, don't play things, say something. Mm. When you're playing music, you're communicating with somebody. So what are you saying to them? You know? And so if you're not saying anything to anybody, you're not going to connect with them. That's what I love about music, is like, am I really saying something, or am I just repeating, you know, B flat, G, D, on a fretboard? That does nothing to people. That's
Go ahead. Well, I was gonna ask you, like, have you ever had one of those moments live where you had an epiphany, you know, where you were maybe practicing something in the studio, trying to perfect something in the studio, you go to a live experience and you get surprised as an artist, you know, performing something that resonates with you and the audience at the same time, or maybe something that you played that maybe you didn't think was going to,
magical moment,
was going to land. And then, you know, it like moved everybody. You know, what kind of epiphanies have you had as in that sense on the guitar live?
What a great question. And the first one that comes to mind is I was playing with a group and we were playing Can't You See from Marshall Tucker Band. One of my favorite songs to play. There's so many great guitar licks in there, but it's a crowd pleaser, right? Everybody loves hearing that song. And I remember playing, and we got to a part where we were going back and forth between myself and the keyboard player and the other guitarist, and you're playing different pieces. Well, there's a part at the very end where the lead guitarist plays this, I won't sing the part to you, but what happened was the lead singer and guitarist and I started playing that same solo in thirds. So he started playing at a spot and I went and played at a different spot, and we harmonized on guitar. It's not that way on the album, but it just, and you can see people just turning and looking and listening like, what is that? It's almost it was the brilliance of the Eagles, yeah. Right? The Eagles use so many harmonies. Good grief. That's another band I would have loved to see. But the harmonies make the hair on people's arms go up, right?
Yeah.
When people either sing a harmony or play a harmony, boy, it can just give you the chills.
Yeah,
why that is, man. I think it's divine. You can't explain it. It just happens. And so that was one of those moments where I prepared like that. where it came out to a way that you're just like, this is incredible. And another one was, I had a band and we got asked to play for it was called Service in the Park. And it was this organization that gave supplies to homeless and down and out folks. And they served about 400 or 500 people on that day. Toiletries, clothes, food, people showed up to, you know, treat their animals, all this stuff. And so they said, we'd love to have a band play. And so we said, we'll play on one condition. You hire a real sound company. Because we don't want to do it without doing it right if we're going to perform for this group. So the sound company donated their time. They normally do big gigs. They brought all their gear, set it all up for us. And we played 26 songs. And what I didn't realize was the connection that you would have with this group. You know, we played everything from REO Speedwagon to we played Kryptonite. I remember playing that song, was awesome. And you're playing all these songs. And so it wasn't so much something I did or something the band did, but it was you took this crowd that you normally never interact with. You're not going to interact with a bunch of, you know, group of homeless, 400 homeless people, you know, that are down and out, but you're giving them a concert. They can't afford to go to a concert.
Yeah.
And here we played for 3 hours, you know, and that was a cool experience. And we ended up doing that for probably 3 or 4 years. We would go do that concert and, you know, give them the experience that they probably never get.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of those fans afterwards and interact with them? What are they?
Yeah, they would come up and talk with us even in the middle and afterwards we'd interact and they were just so thankful, you know, to listen to live music and not feel, I think they probably have been around when there's live music, but what are they asked to do? Leave.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, you're not welcome here. You don't have a ticket or, you know, you're making other people uncomfortable and, you know, it's a tough crowd. We had to have security there as well, you know, to make sure. But what's interesting is even in that subculture, there are people who keep the peace. You all of a sudden start to see who the leaders are and you see, you know, somebody starts to get out of line. Somebody's going to snap them into, you know, but that was cool. You know, you're not there for money. You're not there for anything, but, you know, just serving this group of people and playing music for them. And of course they all scream out songs they want to hear and, you know, but
yeah, that's amazing. It reminds me of when, you know, Johnny Cash played Folsom Prison, you know, when he's playing in front of those guys and, you know, and every time I listen to that live album, it gives me chills, you know, I was thinking about that context of what he was doing. And in that, you know, they always say, oh, he played that song and getting riled up. You know, they were like, you know, in the history, the backstory behind that performance was like, oh, you can't play this, you know, and there you're going to get him riled up or, you know, different things like that. And Johnny Cash is like, I'm just going to play, you know, for them. And, you know, they don't get to experience this and they should, you know, and it may help them. Maybe may even be therapeutic, you know, for them. Right.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you on that.
And I know there was some stories that came out with some of those people in the audience that were in prison. They came out with their own music down the road. They became musicians and
were inspired by that
experience. And they might have already been playing, but obviously when they were in prison, they weren't able to continue their playing. And so there were some that touched them so much that they formed bands.
Huh.
Later on too.
Really?
That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, you think of things about music and golf and there's a lot of different things where people just need an avenue, right? Push their energy. So I remember being in college and I was poor and broke. My family didn't have anything. And I remember I went to a guitar lesson. I was like, I'm going to take guitar more serious. And went to my first lesson, a guy named Mark Miller, great guitarist. And I show up and I had to have pliers because my heads were broken. So the only way to tune it was like using pliers, you know? And he's like, all right, we're going in the store and I'm going to make them give you a good deal to get a good guitar. You know, so you're thinking sometimes you just need people to pick you up, you know, and help you get to the next step and the next level.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too. I mean, that's the, I always say the live music experience is one of the most unique experiences that we experience as humans. You know, it has all these things going on that, you know, don't transfer. You can't get anywhere else. Right. You know, seeing a movie or just different, there's just different things, right? That don't apply, to that. And taking the live music experience and inserting it into these different, even like social situations, playing for regular fans, at your standard concert, playing, for, homeless people, who don't get to experience that, playing in prisons, and these different, like, and there's all these different interesting, environments, that can explain. And you brought up a great point earlier, about, how many people does it take to create a live show? And I was thinking about your buddies that you're talking about earlier, that you're like, this is a concert, and Colleen and I will often have this, I don't know if it's like it's more of a conversation. It's not really a
Like,
debate.
does there have to be two or
Like
more? Or
what constitutes
when two or more come together, we have a live concert.
Like when does it become a concert, right? Like, is it because there's an audience size? Is it audience size? Is it length? Is it where you are at? All these different things. Because we'll go and see a piano recital for our kids, or we'll go see something here and there. And sometimes we think of concerts as this like big thing that has to be like, big stage, lights, screaming. You have to pay a certain amount of money, for it to be a concert or all these different things.
Gonna be a
But
campfire type experience
for your
where some
friends,
acoustic
right? Like
guitar.
you, I love that how you describe your friends just got together, and you guys are jamming there, and you were trading off probably being, the recipients and the givers of the experience. How do you define what a concert is? Like how do you go about defining that?
That's a challenging question, because I think if you had asked me before that nice little diatribe right there, I would have said, it's at a big venue and it was,
Oh,
a
sorry.
concert is this or that. But I think it's good. It's a good challenge because I was just talking to my wife earlier this year about, it'd be fun this year to maybe have once a month, just have people come over and play some live music stuff. I just had a friend come back from Texas, and he goes out and performs a lot solo, just acoustic guitar and himself, and he loves it. He's a military guy, works for the Air Force Academy now as a colonel, but plays a lot of country music stuff, and he's constantly saying, "Come on, let's go play." And but to me, it's more terrifying to play in front of a few people than
Oh,
it is.
really?
It's same for me with public
Really?
speaking. I do keynote speaking and such, and I'd much rather speak to 1,000 people than 10. I mean,
Yeah.
it's I
Why?
can there's
Why is
some
it?
connection
Why?
there.
Why? Why do you
Okay,
think
so
that is?
I worked with a counselor one time, and I said, "What's the deal here?" I said, "I would much rather go and be on stage and perform. I would much rather go to a conference and be the keynote rather than be in the audience." And I'm explaining the scenarios. Well, on the Myers-Briggs and other tests, I am an extreme introvert. I'm a trained extrovert. I worked in ministry. I worked in the golf profession. I'm a keynote speaker. So people say, "Oh, no, you're an extrovert." No. My batteries are just going down and down and down as I'm engaged. And so he said, "You love performing and you love keynoting because it doesn't drain your batteries. There's no two-way where you're on the other side." That's why when I leave performing live, I am amped up. I mean, I can't sleep. I go home and I just can't sleep. I just keep thinking about the music. I want to talk to my bandmates about, "Man, did you hear when we did this? Did you hear when we did that?" But when I go to a concert on the other side, I go home drained. It's funny. I consume it the same, but I'm exhausted when I get home. So it's kind of interesting. My perspective is I look at the concert side of, okay, well, is my energy going up or is my energy going down? So kind of an intriguing piece, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if it really answers what it is, but that's how I view it. Is I love to perform. It scares the Dickens out of me. It makes me practice. That's a lot why I like to perform, is because I don't practice enough unless I have the. If I know I'm going to play here in April and I'm going to play a set of 20 songs, I'm in my studio every day and I'm
Yeah.
preparing, I'm getting ready. If I don't have anything booked, I won't pick up a guitar the entire time. There's no motivation, there's no reason, because you want to go. If you're going to perform, I find it's a responsibility. If you're going to go out and perform, you need to be ready. people are coming to engage. They're coming to be entertained and connect, and don't go over there and be a slop, you know. Know what you're doing, be ready. And so that's exciting to me. So a lot of times I just call bands that let me sit in with them and I say, hey, can I play with you in March? And they'll say, yeah, sure. Come join this gig here. And so we'll decide on 10, 12, 15 songs. And okay, now I'm coming home from work and I can't wait. In the studio, got to practice, got to be ready. Might go watch them perform and listen to their shows and listen to what they're doing so that I can connect in with that and hear those pieces. So, hey, before we go, I want to make sure I tell you, if you ever come out to Red Rocks, we have a cool thing happening in Colorado Springs. We have a brand new 8,000 seat Sunset Amphitheater opening.
Wow.
Yeah, we're calling it Red Rock South, but okay. There's a big developer down here. And we're pretty pumped. They're going to basically have another Red Rocks type deal. And you're going to look across and look west at the Air Force Academy and be able to see the Academy. It's about 3 or 4 miles from my house. So we'll probably stop going to Red Rocks and start going here. They just announced One Republic's going to be the opening act because Ryan Tedder, that's the lead singer, right, for One Republic. He grew up here in Colorado Springs, and I think they're a keyboard player as well. So they just announced that. So we're pumped about having that kind of live music right here in Southern Colorado and not having to fight the traffic and get to Red Rocks. And it's a beast of a move to get up there, you know? So if you do end up making a plan, maybe you'll have to make it a double whammy. You can see Red Rocks and then you can see the new Sunset Amphitheater. Pretty fun stuff.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome.
It must become your backyard. You know, these venues do become a big part of what the community has to offer and socializing. And I mean, it's just a big part of that area. And we talk a lot about generations interacting at a live venue and how amazing that, like, we can talk about our grandparents going to the same music hall or concert, outdoor venue that we did, you know, our grandparents. So it's some of these venues really become part of history. Yeah.
And so then, if you could pick a show to watch at Red Rocks, what would it be?
Oh, which artist?
Yeah, if you could pick an artist.
I think it'd be a toss-up for me between live? Dave Matthews.
Oh.
Mm. I've heard his live version of being at Red Rocks, or the Grateful Dead. The Dead and Company, I should say.
And they come, I think they come there once a year.
Yeah.
I don't know about Dave Matthews. I know Blues Traveler plays around 4th of July every year. Dave Matthews, boy, that would be ridiculous. Talk about musicians, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What about you, Chris?
I think it's you didn't put constraints on whether they're alive or not. If I had a choice, Queen.
Ooh.
At Red Rocks, just to hear Freddie Mercury's voice live in that environment, I think would be amazing. I think alive, I'd have to see Radiohead, I think, would be one. I once blindfolded myself at a show and I took it off halfway through, and it was like visually and sonic, like rush was like just, you know, was never forget it. So I think those are two. Maybe a couple hip hop artists, maybe like a Kanye West or as well. I think that just the acoustics and also the you know, the surrounding environment. But man, just to hear Freddie Mercury's voice in that environment. I think those are my.
Yeah. Are you an Eminem fan?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were talking earlier in the show about the poetry and the lyrics.
Yeah.
In my mind, I was thinking about Eminem because it's the words that really, he speaks what people have lived. Right. I mean, he shares their pain and their world and so that's pretty cool. Well, I hope you get to Red Rocks. I'll finish with another. I have a funny story about my one of my least favorite concerts ever was at Red Rocks, and it was because it was cold and raining.
Yes.
And it was, I think it was Styx, REO Speedwagon 38 Special. But I have a funny story about Tommy Shaw. So I'm, thankfully, I told my wife, I said, you remember this show? I was a total turd. I was had a bad attitude and we're sitting in like this planter box and I'm pouting basically because I want to go home and I'm cold. And she's like, I don't remember that. And I said, okay, forget I said that. I had a great attitude, you know? So I said, thank you for being gracious, but we're at this show and it's totally raining. And what happens is the stage gets wet. And Styx is playing and Tommy Shaw comes out and he's jamming some guitar lick and he totally goes head over heels and slams his head on the stage.
Oh, geez.
And the whole crowd is like, did he just knock himself out? Mm. You know, because it didn't look good. And so he's lays on the ground and plays the rest of the song
on his back.
I mean, he just lays on the stage on his back and plays the rest of the song. He gets up at the end of the song and the crowd goes quiet and he goes to a mic and goes, it was so funny because, you know, the whole crowd felt it like, oh, he might be leaving in an ambulance, you know?
Yeah. Was he, did he keep playing when he, like, as he was falling, or did the music stop and then he kept, and then he started?
No. Band never stopped.
He never stopped.
He hit the ground, slammed his head and laid on the ground and played the rest of the song. He never got up.
Wow.
But he lay there on the ground playing. But then when he got up and screamed ouch to the whole crowd, everybody just busted up laughing like, we know, we saw it. So now after every song, they're out there with towels, you know, wiping the stage down. So
get the squeegee.
No blood, though. There was no blood.
No blood. Okay. But I'm sure he had a headache for a while. But
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We've seen some artists bite it hard. Yeah. And some don't get back up and they're like, oh, okay, I guess it's over. And then some of them are like, you know, hey, this is rock and roll, it's punk, you know. And
some you wonder, is it part of the show? Like, yes. At first.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. You're kind of like, was that planned or was that, you know, that's like, they're so good at that. Like, you don't know, like, am I part of the show? You know, is that choreographed? Did they just choreograph that? Like, or, you know, so it's
planned
crazy.
Or not planned.
Right? Yeah. So what shows do you have coming up, Ty? You have ones you're going to or going to be playing out soon?
I don't have anything on the books right now. I mean, we have been so busy getting my daughter finished up for college. And my one buddy just left his band playing with Smoke. So things are a little up in the air. So I got to get something in the docket, something in the plans. So I think we've talked about a few summer shows that are coming up, but nothing is booked at the moment. We have a big country fest that happens in up by Buena Vista. Mm-hmm. Dirks Bentley, I think, has a house up there, so he plays up there a lot. We've been talking about going to that. Or there's a big festival on the Western Slope in Grand Junction. I just saw the lineup come out for that. But it's funny, I'm really struggling right now in between the wanting to go to watch live shows and wanting to dig into more playing. Hmm. My kids are 19 and 21, so we're in this weird phase of empty nesters. So we're kind of like, oh, I got this time, I could start practicing more, could get a band rolling. So yeah, it's good to be on the podcast. It's like a kick in the butt, you know.
Well, whatever, you know, way we can motivate you, you know.
Chris, right now likewise. I'm a better guitar collector, and
you have an amazing collection.
It's funny, I got stuff all over the rest of the place. And my wife, we used to have a joke, whenever Amazon showed up, she would say guitar pedal, you know. It was just the joke in the house. So
do you have any names for your guitars?
Not really. They're all very special. I mean, you see this white one here. I always wanted to have a Jimi Hendrix with a mint green. Amber Ash is an American Telecaster, and it's a lot out after Bruce Springsteen and Tom Petty playing there. Les Paul, you see, very special. They're all very special guitars to me. I've had some people in my life that made them possible for me to own them. I probably would have never owned them for the quality they are. But, you know, like you see Ryan Roxy up there in the poster. He signed that poster for me and whatnot. But so they're just, you know, they're special and they're all different. The wood one you see in the back is actually a contest to me and another guitarist in a band had to see who could buy the least expensive guitar and make it sound the best. So I bought that guitar for $150 and he showed up with $100 guitar, and you know, we had built them all up and tried to, you know, see who could get the best tone and the best sound. And I love that guitar. I love playing live with it. It's got a great kind of a you know, it's kind of a Lynyrd Skynyrd sound, kind of that Southern rock feel to it. So
is that the winning guitar then, or the losing guitar?
Well, I think we won in different ways. So,
I see.
Yeah, different nights.
It was a tie.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. So fun. Like I said, I need to become as good of a guitarist as I am a collector of. I just love the history of it too. I love the history of why a guitar connects with different folks and why they play different ways. And so, whether it's pedals, whether it's amps, speakers, musicians get a little bit of a junkie. I mean, I got this beautiful Roland electric piano you see in the background, and I bought it. It's about a $4,000 piano I found in a thrift store consignment shop for $500.
Wow.
So it's just funny. You shop around and you find yourself going around to places looking pawn shops. You know, you're always looking for this piece of history, you know, like what connects to an artist that you loved watching play. Or so that's what musical instrument stuff to me is what's the connection to the music, to the artist. So yeah. appreciate you asking all the questions and being able to jump on with you.
Oh, it's been fantastic, Ty. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much
for being with us and spending the time sharing the stories.
Live Fix Podcast is a production of Live Fix Media and is produced by Chris and Colleen Catania. Hey, we know every concert fan has a live music story to share, and we'd love to share yours in a future episode. So head on over to livefixpodcast.com and click on Share Your Story. We look forward to hearing from you. Like what you heard? Did you get inspired by the stories of your fellow concert fans? Then help support Live Fix Podcast by subscribing and sharing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate your support, and thanks for listening.